Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of The Occasionalists. Matt Pagel here, once again flying the ship solo with you on this Wednesday, March 6, 2024. Did you know that on this day in 1980, Susan Lucci loses for the first time Best Lead Actress for the Daytime Emmy Awards? And why is this notable? Probably if you're, this is something that I kind of was barely aware of, but certainly people younger than me probably are not aware of this. But Susan Lucci was nominated 21 times for her, for her work on All My Children. And she was nominated 18 times as the lead actress for, 18 consecutive times she was nominated for lead actress for the Daytime Emmys for her role in All My Children. And she lost 18 times consecutive before winning. Or I guess 17, what, doesn't really matter. But she lost 18 times consecutive before winning in 1999. So that's a long, long losing streak for someone who's, like a legend in the soap opera genre of entertainment. So that is Susan Lucci on this date in 1980, March 6, 1980. Lost for the first time the lead actress lead actress Daytime Emmy for her role on All My Children. But enough about soap operas. Let's talk about some baseball, baby. Talking MLB baseball. I guess I'm not really entirely sure what other kind of baseball we'll be talking about. I don't think we've ever talked about college baseball on this podcast. Or Mexican League baseball or something. So whatever. But anyway, we're talking about the MLB, and we'll jump right into this one. I think the one that has, certainly in my lifetime, the big topic, the big issue that's always been at the forefront for Major League Baseball teams, especially if you're a fan of a team like I am, from a mid to small market. I don't think that's the correct way to put it. I think the correct way to put it is to call it a middle or small revenue team, because there are definitely teams in quote unquote large markets, the Miami Marlins, the Minnesota Twins, the Oakland A's. I mean, the Bay Area, right? There are certainly teams in larger markets that are still lower revenue teams. They're just not making the money that the Yankees are making, the Mets are making, the Dodgers are making, so on and so forth. So this is the obvious problem, right? The payroll imbalances, the fact that the Dodgers can go and spend in an offseason quite literally like $1 billion on payroll, whereas the Guardians are struggling to afford to extend arbitration eligible players, and it's just they just compete in two different worlds basically, and it's like it's always been the bigger teams, the higher revenue teams always have had somewhat of an advantage, but it seems like that advantage has just grown to bizarre proportions now. And really, we could talk about the Shohei, and we will talk about the Shohei Ohtani deal and how insane it is, but whatever, it is what it is, and the Dodgers can do what they want to do. But I think really where it kind of where the payroll imbalance and this idea of small revenue versus large revenue teams really kind of comes to fruition are the players that make up those middle ground players on your roster that make up, that are quality players, contributing players, but aren't star players. Guys like Starling Marte, Nick Castellanos, trying to think of some other guys that kind of pop out as being in this sort of class, if you will. But those kind of guys that, maybe you sign them to 2-3-4 year deals or whatever, you're never going to give them an 8 year deal, a 10 year deal. You're going to keep them in shorter term deals. They're never going to make the most money, but they're not like at league minimum players because they're better than that. But the problem is that those players, they end up in Philly, they end up in Los Angeles, they end up in New York because those teams are willing to overpay for them. That they're willing to give them on a short-term deal, $25 million a year, whereas they're really not worth, you can talk about how good someone like Nick Castellanos is. He's not better than like Jose Ramirez, who's making like equivalent money. So that's what's really kind of those types of players certainly are, I think, are the best example of like why this is, you know, why the payroll stuff has just gotten out of control. You know, those middle ground players, and even a layer under that, sort of the real useful role players, the real useful, I'll call them useful starters, right? They're not difference makers necessarily, but you plug them in your lineup, you know, for maybe 100 to 120 games, and they will rarely lose you a game. They might not win you a bunch of games, but they'll almost never lose you a game, right? So you think guys like, you know, like a Tommy Pham, you think of guys like, you know, there's a lot of like relief pitchers that probably fall into this category who, you know, they have like one or two good seasons, but they're, you know, they never really reach the great heights of some of the closers or whatever, but they're never like bad relievers either. There's just like a lot of guys like that. I'm trying to think who else. Tommy Pham, Jock Peterson, maybe is one of them. Just don't let them play fantasy football together. But the league has plenty of these types of players that are just, you know, they're quality players to put on a roster. But again, you know, the Guardians aren't necessarily going to go to Tommy Pham and say, hey, you know, we give you 2 years, $20 million for you to be, you know, a better than what we have, but not like a difference maker. Whereas other teams are more than willing, other teams like the Dodgers, like the, you know, and the Mets, whatever, they're more than willing to pay that to get that sort of depth, you know, where they can hit Tommy Pham. I don't know why Tommy Pham stuck in my head, but he's just like one of those players I think about as being this type of player. You can on a lower revenue, lower payroll team, if he was on the A's or if he was on the Guardians, they'd probably stick him more towards the middle of the order. But if, you know, if Tommy Pham were to sign with the Yankees or the Mets or something, he'd probably be hitting eighth or ninth, but still making like, you know, $10, $15 million a year on a short deal, because those high revenue teams have no issue paying for that type of player. So this is the obvious problem, right? Like I don't know what the obvious answer, I mean, there are some obvious answers, you know, salary caps, salary floors for some teams. Instituting, you know, some kind of ability for, you know, like a Bird, like a Larry Bird kind of rule, where you're able to sign your own free agents, or I should say the players that you drafted, you're able to sign to the biggest free agent deals, that kind of stuff. I mean, there's a bunch of possibilities, but this is what it is, right? And I really hate when, so Shohei Ohtani signed that massive 10-year, $700 million deal, but as it turns out, it's really a 10-year, $20 million deal with $680 million deferred over the following 10 seasons, which means that when Ohtani is done playing baseball, I would assume altogether, but you never know. He might get past that. I doubt he gets past that contract and be like in his late 30s, but if he does, if anyone could, it would be him. He's just not a human being. But what that means is that once Ohtani's contract is up, regardless if he signs another deal or goes to play somewhere else, the Dodgers will continue to pay him $68 million a year for the next 10 seasons. It's not like it's deferred off. It is on the payroll. He will be their highest paid player by far for the following 10 seasons. And that's been sort of when the Dodgers and other people, when Dodgers players and front office personnel were kind of asked about this, in the weeks following the big signing, they gave the most disingenuous line of all time that, well, you know, other teams could have done that. Any team could have done that, could have signed it. You know, it's any team could defer money like that. No, not any team could defer money like that. If the Guardians or the Rays deferred $68 million for even a single season, it would completely fuck up their payroll for that season, you know, for that season and probably the following season as they try to recover from it. And we could get into the arguments about, you know, like these people, you know, the owners should be spending more money. I agree. They should be spending more money. But the amount of revenue coming into teams like the Dodgers, teams like the Yankees, versus the amount of revenue that the Guardians pull in, or the amount of revenue that the Miami Marlins pull in, it is astronomically different. Just for a quick example here, you know, I know the Guardians and some other teams are going through some stuff with Diamond Sports, the company that owns Bally's, Diamond Sports Group, the company that owns Bally Sports, you know, that broadcast all the games on TV. They're going through some contract issues. about, you know, how much they're owed or whatever. I think the Guardians and most teams that are also going through this are essentially guaranteed like $60 million for the season, which it sounds like a lot of money. It is a lot of money. It's $60 million. They're, you know, that's like what they're guaranteed. But then like when you, but then when you compare that with the Yankees, who have a large stake in their own television network, their games, their broadcast rights for their games net them something like, I want to say it's closer to $1 billion. It's like a $1 billion deal over like a few seasons. So it's like they're making like $600 million like a season. They're making 10 times as much off of TV revenue. I don't have those numbers right in front of me, but that's just the general point. That the Dodgers team, I remember, actually, I do know this for a fact. It was before Bally Sports had the Guardians games. I can't remember who did. I guess it was just like Fox Sports Ohio or whatever. And that deal was like, that deal was worth, I want to say it was worth $200 million over like 8 years or 5 years or something like that. Whereas the Dodgers at the same time signed a TV rights deal that was paying them $200 million per year. So the money is just not even in the same planet, regardless of how rich the owners are. And guess what, folks? People who are billionaires, they did not become billionaires by just giving their money away. And they're not going to. So that's, you know, calling for them to spend more money. Yes, I agree they should. They just won't. And that's just the reality of it. But again, to say that any team could spend $700 million in Shohei Ohtani and defer, you know, 90% of it to 10 later years, no team can do that. It actually, I have a feeling we're going to find out that it was going to be very irresponsible of the Dodgers to even do that. Now, but what about the, sorry, I didn't mean to go on for so long about that one, actually. That was a little bit too long for, you know, for the obvious problem. But what about the non-obvious problems here that are also facing baseball? So let's start with one that I don't think is the worst one, but I think it's one that is kind of going unnoticed in a way, and I'll explain why. And that's the reduction of the manager. The manager in baseball, maybe of any individual league and team sport, maybe has the least amount of power of any head coach or, you know, man, you know, he's not a coach. He's a coach, but he's called a manager. Has probably the least amount of power at this point than an NFL coach, a college basketball coach, NBA coach. Take your pick. They probably have the least amount of power because now the front offices and the analytics departments are the true managers in terms of game planning and strategy. The manager is there more or less to, not that they're like completely cucked in this situation. They obviously have insight. Most managers played baseball, have been around baseball for a long time. They have insights to provide into this process of game planning and strategy and everything else. But the front office and the analytics departments, the advanced scouting and so on, they are going to cook up in consultation with the manager. They're going to cook up a game plan, a pitching plan, an approach, and then the manager signs off on it and says, yes, that's what we're going to do. So they are truly, the balance of power has kind of shifted significantly, and it's been happening for a while, but it is significantly shifted to, especially, and I say this because the Guardians had moved on from Tito Francona, who's, you know, stepping back to focus on his health. And Tito was definitely one of the last managers that really had a big say in everything. You know, you hear some of the inside stories about how the Guardians for a long time, yeah, going back to when Mark Shapiro was president of baseball ops and GM, or maybe it was, I don't remember his exact title, but he was in baseball operations before moving into park operations before he moved on to Toronto, I believe. Yeah, Toronto. Shapiro, you know, we were one of those teams along with the Oakland A's in the early 2000s that were very analytics driven. And we've always been that way. And it's totally fine. It gives you an advantage, especially when you're a team that's not, you know, raking in millions and millions of dollars the same way other teams are. Sorry, getting a very roundabout way here to get to my point, as I'm one to do. But the point being that Tito was one of the last managers that was able to, I'm not going to say veto the the game plan necessarily, but he was one of the last managers that when they sat down before a series and they were strategizing with Chris Antonetti and strategizing with the whoever comprises the analytics department. I don't know for sure, you know, who's the president or the director of that necessarily, but I mean, probably the director and president of that is Chris Antonetti, but whoever his team is, it wasn't like Tito would sit there and say, no, we can't do this. Tito would go, okay, I understand what the point is, but here's my experience with this. Here's my experience with this particular situation and this, and here's what I'm seeing out of this particular pitcher, in recent outings, in recent days, blah, blah, blah. So this is why this might not work out well. And so he was one of the last managers that was able to have that more direct back and forth to say, like, okay, I get the game plan here, but here's where we might need to change. And here's the reason why we might need to change this, or why this situation might not come up the way you think it is. Because Tito was, he's been there and done that for, 40 years of his life playing baseball and managing baseball. And the front office was like, okay, great. That's you think that, if this situation comes up this way, more power to you. You take care of it the way you think you should take care of it. And now the Gardens have moved on from him to Stephen Vogt, who I'm sure seems like a pretty great guy. He's definitely a smart guy. Catchers are always good managers because they're basically managers on the field. But I know that he, especially as a first year manager, certainly does not have the power to tell Chris Antonetti and his team, hey, I get what you're saying, but this is what we're going to do instead. Does not have that power. So, what do managers do, right? Like, really what the manager is, after everything gets agreed upon by the manager and the front office, the manager really is about managing the personalities in the clubhouse, managing situations, conflict. There really are more like high school principals, right? Like, that's really what their job is at this point, to just keep morale, make sure the students aren't acting up, handle high level situations with your players. You have to be the front facing kind of spokesperson for the team. That's really what their role is now. Since Dusty Baker retired, I guess Bruce Bochy is probably now the last sort of, the last manager that really is sort of like that really is, of course, sort of the captain of the ship on the field. Obviously, he's not doing anything without consulting the front office either, but he definitely is one of those managers, as a now four-time World Series champion manager, has quite a bit more cachet with his opinion than maybe any other first-year manager would have. So yeah, Boch is probably the last manager that we're ever going to see that has much more leverage than what modern managers have now. And I think I kind of mentioned this before. It's kind of sight unseen because I don't think fans get this. Like, fans still get pissed off at managers for doing things a certain way. This guy's mismanaging the bullpen, or they don't play this guy enough, or they need to pull him on this. And I'm like, it's really not the manager's fault, because the manager basically just signed off on doing what the front office said to do, right? Like, I don't think the average fan just gets really how much the front office, and for that matter, the owner, how much say they have. I think there's this perception that the owner like writes checks and sits there. Bullshit. The owner, the person paying everybody, has a big voice in the room. And it's usually through like the president of baseball ops or GM or whatever the title they give them, right? That's usually the owner's voice. But it's crazy if you think that the people who are shelling out all the dough for their team have like no say in this. So, whenever the manager is mismanaging the bullpen or mismanaging, thinking about like one of the biggest examples when during the World Series, when Blake Snell was absolutely dealing, it was the Rays, it was the COVID series, the Rays and the Dodgers, and Blake Snell was dealing, and Kevin Cash went out and got Blake Snell, and you could see Blake Snell kind of just like, well, are you kidding me? Made a face and, kind of walked off. Because that was the game plan, right? Like, that was the game plan, that after seeing the top of the order this many times, we're going to go to the bullpen. I think And Kevin Cash is a very good manager, obviously. But I think if in that same situation, let's just say that was Bruce Bochy managing, I think Bruce Bochy would have had the go-ahead from the front office to, if not buy him as long as he wanted, buy him at least one more inning, to get Snell through Betts, and I can't remember who else, probably Bellinger. He would have had at least one more opportunity to get through all those guys versus, pulling him right when he hit that mark that they were looking for. But anyway, this is why I also think it's very hypocritical when managers get fired by the front offices. I mean, I get it. You can't fire the players and the front office isn't going to fire themselves. So you got to fire the manager, I guess. But I think it's so hypocritical because I'm just like, well, like, you guys tell him what to do, so maybe you should fire yourselves. But regardless, I just think it's a problem in that it really does sort of reduce the I feel like more baseball games get played without a feel for the game than they ever have before, simply because we are predetermining what's going to happen on certain counts, certain, whatever. Like, we just know what's going to happen beforehand. And when things go awry, when you're not, like, really prepared for it, or if you're only prepared for certain scenarios, you're not getting that feel of the game, then, you accidentally take out your pitcher who's dealing and cutting everybody down, and you put in a reliever who's not dealing and cutting everyone down, and you lose the World Series. So I just think it's not like the game is markedly worse necessarily, but I think every sport benefits from having coaches who have a good feel for the game, that know when it's time to do certain things and when it's time to not do certain things. All right, here, and we'll wrap up with this last baseball problem. This one I do feel like is a more of a problem, and it's really more in terms of, to me, like the watch. This would affect the watchability of the game. And I'm talking about launch angle. You probably, if you're a baseball fan or if you're just a sports fan in general, you've probably heard that term bandied about. Essentially, it's the angle at which you hit the baseball, right? Like, a higher launch angle means the ball carries in the air more. Lower launch angle, it's more of a line drive or a ground ball. Pretty straightforward, right? And it makes sense that you want to give the ball a little bit more carry, than you do. You want the ball to launch higher at a higher angle, obviously, because you get more carry on it, which is usually better than just pounding the ball straight into the ground. But it's just not that simple, right? I think home runs are very, very fun, but I don't think everyone should be trying to hit them. And I say this because most players are not home run hitters. They are not. Players more frequently than in times past can run into home runs and hit them. They're bigger, faster, stronger than they ever have been. But correspondingly, pitchers are bigger, faster, stronger than they ever have been. I don't want to say pitchers are better, but there's so much more velocity now that it is much easier to get above the barrel of a bat of a pitch of a, excuse me. Pitchers can throw with so much more velocity now that they can get above the barrels of hitters' bats much more easily than they could 15, 20 years ago. But again, most hitters, most position players are not home run hitters. We know this because power numbers have definitely risen, in the past several decades, but the corresponding numbers that are hallmarks of a good hitter, be it base hits, the number of strikeouts, base hits have fallen, batting average has fallen, strikeouts have risen, walks have risen too. And that's also a little bit, that goes more to approach. But the numbers that, like, the numbers that you would kind of classically identify with someone like Tony Gwynn, or Pete Rose, or Mark Grace, or someone of that type of player, those type of numbers have drastically dropped off for the average baseball player. While the power numbers in terms of, like, the slugging percentages and the amount of home runs has increased. And I hear, like, the problem that I have with this is that you, as the average baseball player, has a significantly better chance. And I'm not saying that the average baseball player could just become either of these sort of examples, but to use, like, as an as an as, to use this as a kind of an extreme example that would make sense, especially if you are familiar with baseball, this will make perfect sense. The average baseball player has a better shot at becoming Luis Arraez than they do becoming Aaron Judge. Even if they're like a bigger baseball player, you have a much better shot at becoming Luis Arraez than you becoming Aaron Judge. Who's Luis Arraez? If you're not familiar with baseball at all, he was the major leagues I think he was the overall batting champion and obviously the National League batting champion. And previously he had won the batting title in the American League. Prior to that with the Twins, he's with the Marlins right now. He was for a big stretch of the season hitting above 380. And I think he was even above 400, like even in mid to late May, which is a very long time to be above 400. Could have even been into June. He was near or above 400. He had like multiple 5-hit games. Luis Arraez is not a power hitter. He is a line drive singles hitter. Not a slap hitter. He definitely hits the ball harder than that. But he is a contact hitter who controls the ball and can spray it all over the field. And obviously we know who Aaron Judge is, right? We know who this titanic home run hitting man is. We're very familiar with him. He's now the American League's all-time single season home run leader. But you have a better chance at becoming a player that can control the strike zone and can hit the ball where it's pitched and get base hits, more so than you will become the guy who could reset the American League home run record. More players have that opportunity to be a good hitter as opposed to a great all-time power hitter. I know it's an extreme, but the things that make Luis Arraez a good player are things that a lot of players could at least, they can't master the same way he can. I mean, you should see some of the hits this guy gets. They really are. It's really, his back control is completely uncanny. It truly is. But at the same time, that is a skill, staying behind the ball and just driving it where it's pitched is a much easier skill than twerking up and just loading up and trying to blast a ball, 500 feet every single time, no matter where it's pitched. That's something that Aaron Judge does because he's massive, and his massive size, strength, and leverage advantages, he doesn't have to hit balls perfectly, and he can hit balls, away off the plate that maybe most normal guys, it turns into at best maybe a double in the gap, more likely some kind of fly ball out. His carry 400 feet the opposite direction because he can just do it. Whereas Luis Arraez, his sort of skill is learned and something that everyone, not that Aaron Judge doesn't practice and focus on it, but if Aaron Judge was 5'11", 180 pounds, I'm certain that he would not be hitting some of the home runs that he hits. That physically he wouldn't be able to hit the ball the same way. Certainly if he was as small as Luis Arraez, who's like, 5'9", like a 175, 180, something like that. So it is easier when you're just sort of an average player to kind of get that sort of back control, not to the Luis Arraez degree, but to exert more back control and hit for more line drives. I remember seeing this really interesting graphic on, speaking of launch angle, saw this really interesting graphic one night on a show on the MLB Network. I don't remember what show it was, but it was Billy Ripken showing the batting averages by launch angle. And at minus 10 degrees to 10 degrees, and that space, so that 20 degree space essentially off of the, 10 degrees off of parallel, essentially 10 degrees north of parallel, 10 degrees south of parallel, the batting averages, and that's where Luis Arraez gets a lot of his hits. The batting averages in that zone are like consistently above 400. When you begin to dip farther and farther away from that sort of middle range, batting averages naturally drop. Obviously, if you start to get real low on that launch angle, if you're hitting balls at minus 23 degrees, minus 50 degrees, you're just pounding the ball into the ground. You're probably going to hit groundouts. But correspondingly, as you get farther and farther above 10 degrees, a positive 10 degrees, and you get to, 10 to 25, that's like your power range. That's really where you hit a lot of home runs. When you start to get above that and you start to get more towards 30, 35, 40, you're just hitting pop-ups now. And it's much easier to pop the ball up. It's way easier to pop the ball up. Like you just have to just barely miss it to pop the ball up. And because more hitters are swinging, this is I'm tying it back to launch angle, baby, because more hitters are swinging up at the ball, they are more frequently hitting underneath the ball and popping it up and hitting it and hitting it at an undesirable angle. Whereas if they were making, and this is a bigger, this is also part of the problem, players don't adjust to counts and situations anymore at all. Two runners on second and third, you know, one out, players are swinging from the heels and striking out instead of shortening up, trying to hit a fly ball or trying to hit a ground ball the other way. Players are swinging from the heels at with that same high launch angle, trying to crush a three-run home run instead of just trying to focus on making contact to get a run in. I think it's a big problem because again, if you have an Aaron Judge, you have Giancarlo Stanton, Jose Ramirez, Pete Alonso, Shohei Ohtani, Mike Trout, those guys for sure. Corey Seager, Adolis Garcia, those guys for sure. You want them swinging with a higher launch angle. You want them to hit the ball in the air because they can crush it. That's what they're good at. But for the most part, you have guys that are on this spectrum, if you will. You have guys that are much more like Luis Arraez, Stephen Kwan. I'm trying to think of some other singles hitters. Estuary Ruiz. You have more guys that are like that than you have guys that are like Corey Seager or Aaron Judge. And it's one of those frustrating things as a baseball fan that more players aren't realizing this, that like, hey, you know what? I can make a pretty damn good living hitting 315. And maybe my home runs drop from 28 down to, 18, but my batting average went up. My on-base percentage went up. My hits went up. It's just one of those things that just drives me nuts as a baseball fan that we are at that point. And that does it for this episode. We will catch you tomorrow on Thursday when we are talking about the NBA, the problems plaguing the NBA. So we will see you next time.